much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and you can always find us, contact us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And we love to hear from you. Myself and my partner, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, have been bringing you both information about holistic medicine and radio shows and podcasts since 1988, believe it or not. And here on Progressive Radio Network, we have had this show, which is The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and we bring it to you live every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m. And then it is archived, which is one of the wonderful things about Progressive Radio Network. You can tune in anytime you want and get any of our shows. And we do have over 200 that are listed in the Progressive Radio Network archives. And we also have about 150,000 people who download these podcasts regularly. So we are very, very excited to reach out to you, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we have as our guest Norman Robillard, Ph.D. He is the founder of the Digestive Health Institute and is a leading gut health expert. He turned his own suffering from GERD and occasional IBS into a mission to create the drug and free and antibiotic-free fast-track diet for functional gastrointestinal disorders, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth called SIBO, S-I-B-O, and related conditions. His fast-track digestion book is a whole series of books, and I have several of them right here that I'm looking at now, beautiful books, that explain why drugs and antibiotics are not addressing the causes of these conditions. And he provides a science-based, safe, and effective three-pillar approach, including dietary, behavioral, and identifying and addressing underlying causes. The fast-track diet has been endorsed by the New York Times bestseller co-author, Dr. Michael Eads, who is a gastrointestinal surgeon, Dr. Alan Hu, who is a certified osteopathic practitioner, Dr. Lisa Vaughn, as well as certified nutritionists. And the Fast Track Diet has a mobile app also, which gives you the means to put the diet into action on your own with lots of information. And the best place to look, and we'll have this posted on the web podcast as well, is digestivehealthinstitute.org. That's digestivehealthinstitute.org. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Robillard.
Good morning, Ellen. Great to be with you.
And I have a couple of your books, actually, that were mailed to me. One is called Fast Track Digestion, and it's broken down to heartburn. And then another one, Fast Track Digestion, broken down to IBS. That's a good way to have it so that people can really get focused on whatever it is that their issue is involved with.
Right. I mean, we could have tried to put everything into one book, but instead we determined to make it a book series. So if somebody has heartburn, they can buy that book. If their symptoms are more of an irritable bowel syndrome, they can buy the other. And there's many more books that will follow along that line. But it's the same diet.
Yeah, it's really a similar treatment protocol, which is very interesting in holistic medicine, as I mentioned earlier. I've been doing holistic medicine since 1964, that's with a six, so a very, very long time, and it's wonderful to see what we knew worked. And I originally was working with Dr. Bernard Jensen, who, of course, was very involved in digestive issues, as I'm sure you are aware. And the therapies that he talked about now and the ones that you're talking about now really have tons of evidence behind them. It is what the medical literature shows is correct. And you have a vast amount of these literature references in your end notes in the book.
Yeah, it's true. I actually spent, the first part of my career was in biotech and pharmaceuticals. And, of course, some of those drugs we worked on were life-saving, and I'm proud to have worked on them. But my own health problems actually led me to realize the power of diet, especially for functional gastrointestinal disorders. And I agree with you completely that we came up with the solutions, and then we moved past it and right into the drugs again.
Well, you know, there's probably, unfortunately, economic parameters there rather than what is best for individuals.
Well, that very well could be.
So let's go back in time a little bit and talk about your personal history. How did you get involved in a focus on digestion?
Yes, I often wonder about that myself, Ellen. As a microbiologist, I was initially focused on infectious diseases, as were so many of my colleagues. In fact, my doctoral research was on anthrax, Bacillus anthracis. But as a postdoctoral fellow at Tufts University in Boston, I began working on intestinal bacteria, and I developed more of an appreciation for the good things they do. You know, just to review, we have 100 trillion bacteria, mostly in our large intestine, comprised of 1,000 different species. It's a tropical rainforest down there. And they help us break down the foods we can't, mostly complex, you know, carbohydrates. And they provide healthy fats and vitamins that nourish us. So, in fact, these bacteria in our gut, we've evolved with them, and they've helped us avoid starvation, you know, countless times during our evolution. So they're critical, and as we learn more about them, we realize more and more of the good things they do. They maintain our intestinal barrier. I noticed you did a show recently on leaky gut. So they play a role there. They protect our gut from invading pathogens. Some of the big ones in the news recently, you know, Clostridia difficile, but even Salmonella, Shigella, and many others. And they regulate and help develop our immune system from a very young age. And now we know they even help regulate our appetite and fat storage. So they do a lot of good things. Now, this understanding that I developed early on came back to me when I began to suffer with my own digestive health issue. And you probably read about it in the Heartburn book. I had chronic acid reflux myself for many years. And, you know, the drugs, the proton pump inhibitors like Nexium, the H2 blockers, I took my share of Tums. They just really weren't addressing the problem. And I didn't.
Well,
like
I want to ask you something. As a scientist, obviously, you were actually aware of some of these studies because, like in your book, there are brand new studies. In fact, daily there are intense studies coming out between the Association of Gastrointestinal Health and every aspect of life, including mood and including the development of intelligence. I mean, it is very, very broad-based, and I'm sure you already saw some of those older studies, and yet you chose to use the pharmaceutical interventions when you were actually having symptoms back then.
Well, good point. I actually had not read those studies because, you know, my career after Tufts, I was in pharma and biotech, and I was very much focused on life-saving drugs. I was not focused on my own chronic acid reflux, and so I hadn't read a lot of these studies. But not only that, nobody really knew about what the cause of acid reflux was. There had been studies, you know, for 60 years they thought it was because these lower esophageal sphincter muscles at the top of our stomach that are supposed to keep it closed was dysfunctioning, and it was spontaneously relaxing perhaps in response to trigger foods. But I realized through an experience I had that that was probably not what was going on at all. In fact, I hadn't read those stories, the studies you were talking about, but I just happened to go on a low-carbohydrate diet about 10 years ago to lose a few pounds. But it was that, the observation about what happened, that really set me on a different course. Before I lost a pound, within 2 days, my acid reflux was completely gone. And other people were saying the same thing on the internet, and there had been a small study at Duke University, a pilot study, and sure enough, people went on a low-carbohydrate diet. Their symptoms improved. But I got curious, did carbohydrates somehow cause acid reflux? Now, there's something pharma doesn't want us to know about, right? And so I did some research at that point after making that initial observation, and I, within just a few days studying how proteins, fats, and carbohydrates are processed in our digestive tract, I came up with a completely new theory about what causes acid reflux. And let me state it simply for you.
Please.
Many of us, including myself at the time, are consuming more carbohydrates, and the harder to digest ones we'll talk about in a little while, but more carbohydrates than our system can effectively digest and absorb. And so the result is more of these unabsorbed carbohydrates in the small intestine where they potentially feed blooms of gas-producing bacteria. And I remembered from studying and growing these bacteria that most of these bacteria are saccharolytic. That means they prefer carbohydrates as a fuel source, and most of these bacteria produce a lot of gas. And so this was the theory. Carbohydrates, too many of them were feeding overgrowths of bacteria, making all this gas, and it was building up pressure in our small intestine and even in the stomach. And reflux was occurring not because of the sphincter malfunctioning, but rather like a mini volcano or dropping Mentos candy into a bottle of Coke. And there's a lot of evidence for this idea that I write about in my books, especially this fast-track digestion heartburn. But from there, I realized that most other functional gastrointestinal disorders, irritable bowel syndrome, bloating, you know, functional diarrhea, constipation, involved aspects of the same process. And that's when I founded Digestive Health Institute, started blogging, writing books, and consulting with clients on this. I really wanted to share this message, this new idea, new lens.
And it's just amazing to me that gastrointestinal physicians very often, I mean most often, and hopefully that's changing, when someone comes in with a profound gastrointestinal illness, depending, you know, regardless of what the specific diagnosis is, but basically they're having trouble with their digestion, gastroenterologists often do not even ask, in fact, it's not even on the intake history, like a three-day diet diary, what are you eating? That doesn't even seem to be in the thought process of what's going on in your gastrointestinal tract.
I couldn't agree more. And unfortunately, you know, some
possible, though. How is that possible?
There's a lot of medical training they have to have. There's many serious illnesses they have to, you know, be responsible for. But when it comes to diet, they're not paying attention to some of the textbooks. Just sitting right next to me is this textbook of primary and acute care medicine. I look at this book all the time. It's used to train doctors. And on page 1192, this chapter on intestinal gas, which we now know is the underpinning of all of these illnesses, to control intestinal gas, it tells you right in the book, you need to really cut back on the foods that have lactose, fructose, resistant starch, fiber, and sugar alcohols, and some of these oligosaccharides of fructose and other sugars. So there was the key. That book is published in 2004. And it's really interesting to me. And then also, when you talk about irritable bowel syndrome, you can look back to the 90s, research in the UK, Professor John Hunter's group at Addenbrooke Hospital, and Dr. Mark Pimentel at Cedars-Sinai in LA, his team, they both published definitive studies showing that intestinal gases from bacteria were at the center of IBS symptoms and that a low-fiber diet, which is what Hunter's group was studying, and an elemental diet, which is all pre-digested proteins, fats, and carbohydrates that are easy to digest and absorb, that's what Pimentel's group was studying, could dramatically reduce both intestinal gas and symptoms. And it makes perfect sense, the bacteria feeding on these unabsorbed carbohydrates causing these symptoms, but yet the focus is now back on drugs and antibiotics. It's just beyond me.
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, it does make sense from the pharmaceutical
sales. There's a dietary solution, but I think people like the idea that you can just pop a pill.
Well, it would be nice if that helped, but it usually is kind of a temporary quick fix and comes along with a plethora of possible adverse effects as well.
Oh, it does. And you know, a lot of these common treatments, you know, they're aimed at the symptoms. You know, we talked about PPIs, antidiarrheals, laxatives, pain meds. You know, they're not really that effective. They don't address the root cause. And they all have side effects. And many, you probably read up on this yourself, have very serious long-term health consequences. The proton pump inhibitors, for instance, just horrible. And now the focus is on antibiotics. Now that we know it's a bacterial thing, you know, they want to use antibiotics like rifaximin just got approved for treating diarrhea-predominant irritable bowel syndrome. And I just couldn't disagree with that more, at least for a first line of therapy. You should try diet first. I mean, the antibiotics, they're a shotgun approach. They kill and inhibit the good as well as the bad bacteria, and they deplete these protective strains. And we just talked about how they protect us against pathogens like C. diff. That's why C. diff has its own name, antibiotic-associated diarrhea. So we really need to step back and take a look at this. And not only that, antibiotic use has broad consequences for all of us. 2 million people a year become infected with bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics, and 23,000 people die each year. This is a quote from the CDC. So why are we not looking at these science-based diets? They're evolving. Whether it's the elemental, there's a low-fiber, low-carb, low-FODMAP, paleo, and the newest one is this fast-track diet and fast-track digestion. But the goal is to prevent too many carbohydrates from flooding the intestines. And there's no question in my mind that SIBO can be treated successfully by limiting these carbs.
Well, it's not only a matter of in your mind. It's certainly been documented to be really helpful. And there are actually studies showing that it has been when they do, you know, look at patient outcomes. So it's just mystifying to me, mystifying, that what you're talking about here, Dr. Robillard, is not, as it should be, standard of practice. Like when we prioritize treatment, I feel, as a healthcare provider, that we should be looking at those therapies that give you the best risk-to-benefit ratio first. And then if those don't work over a particular period of time, and of course in these diseases, we can try them for quite a while because they're not deadly diseases instantly. So we have time to actually investigate the least negative kind of therapy and the one with the best risk-benefit ratio. And if that does not work or does not completely work, then move on to pharmaceutical interventions.
You know, well said. And I mean, I believe in a whole foods diet, and so the fast-track diet is not going to hurt you. You know, but I think the burden for drugs, right, is randomized controlled clinical studies, right? And there's not that much money to do that for diets. This is not that much money in diet. It's not a $1 billion business. But we still have to try to do what we can. So we've done one pilot study on the fast-track diet. We're looking for collaborations on further studies. And we just have to do what we can to get this onto the hospital formulary and to get these treatments into doctors' hands. So I did present that data at the Digestive Disease Week meeting a couple of years ago. So I got out of my comfort zone and went in and talked to gastroenterologists about my theory, and one prominent gastroenterologist told me that I was completely wrong. But he listened to my presentation. I gave him a copy of the books that I gave you, and he contacted me a couple months later, and I flew out there, and we had a discussion about collaborating. So we have to do what we can to help doctors understand that these things work, and that then it's not an old trigger food diet. These are very science-based approaches, and we have to help them understand it so they can use it. But you know, when you look at the carbohydrates that we limit in the fast track diet, some of these are no-brainers, and doctors already agree. So here's the carbs we target. You know, I started out making this observation with a low carb diet, but I've finessed it into a diet that just limits the hardest to digest carbohydrates that are most likely to drive symptoms. So even if people, some are vegetarian, some are on high carb, some are on low carb, there's all these different dietary, you know, lifestyles people have. And so I've tried to make this easy and flexible for as many people as possible. But let's look at these carbs. They're lactose, fructose, sugar alcohols, resistant starch, and fiber, right? Now, three of those are already, doctors will agree, if you're lactose intolerant, what do you need to do?
Stop dairy.
Avoid lactose or take a lactase supplement, right?
Right.
You know, and dairy, right, dairy. And watch the high lactose dairy. fructose intolerant, what do? You have to avoid fructose, right? Certain fruits, and then also, you know, garlic has some oligosaccharides of fructose and so forth. The doctors know all about it. If you're sugar alcohol intolerant, which most people will be, look at the FDA website. It warns you about, you know, most of these sugar alcohols, like sorbitol and others. Erythritol is the one gut-friendly sugar alcohol, but most of the other ones will cause diarrhea and bloating because they're not digested, and yet bacteria can ferment them. So there's three examples. The doctors already know this. But then when it comes to dietary fibers, and there's a whole variety of these fibers, and resistant starch, doctors, researchers, and bloggers keep assuming that more is better. There's this idea out there now that we may be starving the microbes in our gut if we don't get enough fiber. But I really reject that. For people with these functional gastrointestinal disorders, I think we need to limit all of these fermentable, you know, carbs. And so look at fiber. The Hunter's group in UK, I mean, they did a study. When they limited fiber in IBS patients, that intervention was more effective than the powerful antibiotic metronidazole. And there's similar studies and hints about resistant starch. A study on bread and muffins that contains a lot of resistant starch, you know, exacerbated IBS symptoms. And, you know, there's just much more information. I could go on and on. But the doctors need to look at these other two groups as well, because some of the other diets don't limit all of these classes of fermentable carbs, whereas the fast-track diet limits them all and does so in a quantitative fashion.
Well, so, you know, when you say the doctors know this, I wonder if that's actually true, because I think a lot of physicians, since if they're working under a managed care kind of situation, they have about 8 minutes to see any particular patient, and I'm not so sure they're reading their studies. It seems like the vast amount of education they do get is from the drug reps, who, of course, are not going to share this information about the link to diet.
Well, you bring up a good point. In fact, I was visiting my doctor for a checkup yesterday, and I just happened to see all of the charts in his room and the posters. They were all produced by drug companies. So, you know, they do get a lot of their information, unfortunately, from the pharma industry, and it would be, you know, great if we could reinforce some of these ideas with doctors.
Yeah, because like you're saying, they know this. I don't know that they know this, because why would they then not ask as a first, right on the history and physical, especially in a gastroenterology office or really in any primary care situation, why do they not ask about diet? I'm just on a vendetta about this, because I think
well,
it should be the first
to the
thing your doctor...
Because, you know, in our consultation business, that's where we start, and we do an extensive questionnaire, and I spend an hour just listening and asking questions to really understand what's going on. And the types of tests that we recommend people get are much different than what you would get in a doctor's office. We want to know how well, how many of these types of carbs they're consuming and how well they're digesting and absorbing them. And so there are diagnostics and ways to get at this, but we really dig in, and we're looking for ways to fix the problem without drugs or antibiotics.
And if people want to know more about that, we're going to take a little break right now on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, but a very good place to go if you want to know more about what Dr. Norman Robillard is discussing is his website, Digestive Health Institute, all one word, digestivehealthinstitute.org. And it's a beautifully done site, easy to navigate, and you'll find quite a bit of information there. And, of course, you can always visit us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse, to find out more. And we will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the nutrient known as taurine.
Amino acids are chemical constituents that form the building blocks of protein in the body. The official definition of an amino acid is a compound which contains an amino group and a carboxylic acid. Taurine contains a sulfonic group instead, so is not a true amino acid, although it is often referred to as one. The intracellular concentration of taurine is 10 times that of any normal free amino acid.
Taurine was discovered in 1827 But the significance of taurine in nutrition was not realized until 1975, when the journal Science published a study showing that taurine-deficient cats suffered from retinal degeneration. In 1986, the Annual Review of Biochemistry reported that the amount of taurine present in mammalian milk depends on the species. Natural human mother's milk is rich in taurine, but cow's milk, except for the early milk known as colostrum, is taurine deficient. Pediatrics Journal in 1983 printed a study which outlined several of the biologically significant functions of taurine, and an effort was then made to fortify infant formula by adding taurine.
Some species of animals, such as cats, cannot synthesize taurine within their bodies, and so must receive it through their diet. Humans have a very limited ability to synthesize taurine, so adequate intake through diet and supplementation is important. The principal source of dietary taurine is meat of various types and shellfish. Even people ingesting sufficiently high levels of taurine may develop a deficiency due to the overgrowth of certain anaerobic intestinal microorganisms which consume taurine. Certain prescription drugs are known inhibitors of taurine uptake.
The Journal of Neurochemistry published a study in 1975 which showed that taurine concentrations are extremely high in the retina. In fact, the retina contains two binding proteins specific for taurine. Research has yet to determine exactly how taurine functions in the eye, but deficiency of taurine has been found to lead to the degeneration of photoreceptor cells. Continued studies on taurine have linked its presence to several biological functions, besides being a protector of the delicate tissues of the eye. Taurine helps to neutralize oxidizing agents caused by ionizing radiation. Taurine is present in high concentrations in the normal heart. It stimulates white blood cell motility and protects cell membranes from free radical damage. Taurine has proven useful in epileptics to reduce or control seizures. It helps modulate the transport of substances such as sodium, potassium, magnesium, copper, and iron across cell membranes. Additional research supports taurine's role in preventing gallstones.
So, as you can see, the nutrient taurine may be an important addition to your natural medicine chest.
Natural Nurse. And as always, we're wishing you the best. And we love to just have you come and meet us in person. And how do you do that? Well, you go to naturalnurse.com and along the top bar, go to calendar. When you click on there, you will see all the information about our on-ground webinars, as well as our online classes. And by the way, many of our classes, both on-ground and online, do give accreditation. And if you are not a licensed professional, you can get a certification for taking our classes. And if you are a licensed professional, you can actually get CE credits. And that includes nurses, midwives, massage therapists, acupuncturists, and dietitians. So again, the same class, if you take it and you are not a healthcare provider or a professional, you get a certification for having taken the class. And if you are a licensed professional, you actually get CE credits. So a lot of people join us for that reason or just to learn for their own education. We have classes where we go out in the field and gather wild plants. We have many of them coming up even this month, and you learn how to make them into your own medicine. Hundreds of people who have taken our classes over the last 30 years that we have been teaching these classes have told us at the time of, let's say, a devastating event, hopefully it doesn't happen in your area, but of course we see them all the time, floods, earthquakes, various things that happen, that the electric goes out and things are a little difficult for a while. All of those people who took our edible and medicinal wild plant classes for fun, many of them have contacted us and say, wow, that came in handy from a survival point of view when we needed it. So it's both educational and fun and also could save your life. So those are good reasons to learn the plants that are outside your door and figure out which ones are poisonous and which ones are food and which ones are medicine. And then we have a lot of tours. One where we actually take you into the jungle to live with shamanic healers for a week. And that goes on once a year in March. And then we have Echo Tours for Cures to Chinatown, where you get to interact with traditional physicians. And when we say traditional, we mean with education that has been effective and safe for 10,000 years. And you learn a lot of those, both philosophical and medical kinds of work that they do. So we have that going on. Some people come just for fun. Some people come for education. And we just would love to meet you, either online or in person. In addition, Dr. Zamperone has an office in Connecticut where he sees patients. And I have a consultation facility in Oyster Bay, Long Island, where many people come in personally. Or, of course, we can do it by phone as well. So thank you again so much for joining us today. Our guest today is Dr. Norman Robillard, and he's the author of many wonderful books. We're looking at two of them here. One is Fast Track Digestion, IBS, Relief Without Drugs, and another one is Fast Track Digestion, Heartburn, Clinically Proven Solution. So these are two things that are very, very common, Dr. Norman Robillard. Let's go into one of them, because I would say heartburn is a condition that is probably even more widely distributed than IBS. And, you know, on TV, they just make it like, well, it's just part of life, so that you can eat all these fried foods and everything and just take some Tums, like you said. What do you talk about in your heartburn book?
Yes, and it's interesting, those two, you know, acid reflux, and one of the symptoms is heartburn, but it's also can cause symptoms of laryngopharyngeal reflux, you know, and many other types of problems. It's connected to asthma. But the incidence of heartburn and IBS are very similar. About 50 to 60 million people suffer with each one of these conditions, and there's a lot of overlap between them. About half of the people with irritable bowel syndrome suffer with acid reflux. About half of the people with acid reflux have IBS symptoms. And that doesn't surprise me, because, you know, I came up with this theory of carbs feeding bacterial overgrowth, making gas pressure, causing reflux. And then Hunter and Pimentel came up with this idea that excessive fermentation of carbs by bacteria was producing a lot of gas, causing symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome. So it's fitting that the two are connected, because I really think they have very similar underlying mechanisms.
Yes, they do. But wouldn't you say that heartburn is more people suffer from heartburn and they just self-treat it?
A little bit more. I mean, it's about 50 million people have regular IBS symptoms and 60 million have heartburn. So, and then many of them have both.
That's right. Well, of course, they're all the same spectrum. It's not like there's one and then there's a division. It often runs into the same issue because the triggers are so similar.
Right. In fact, if you looked at all of the SIBO-related functional gastrointestinal disorders and some systemic and even autoimmune diseases, there isn't a lot of overlap between them. But when you add the incidences for all of those conditions up, you get well over 100 million people that are affected. So that's, you know, a third to a half of the people in this country, because we now know SIBO is connected to not only IBS and GERD, but celiac disease and Crohn's. And, of course, those two have some genetic underpinnings you need to be aware of as well. But diverticulitis, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, asthma, which is a real interesting study. I could do a whole show with you on that. Rosacea, interstitial cystitis, and these autoimmune diseases, and it makes sense through the connection of leaky gut, as well as cystic fibrosis, which is a very interesting story and how that relates to acid reflux. Fascinating story. I wrote a blog article on that one.
Well, you know what? We have time to share some of these fascinating stories, so just choose one and, you know, tell our listeners, like, why is it not a great idea, which they promote on television? You know, they have that guy Larry or somebody, you know, he's just eating all this junk food and just slam dunk some Prilosec over the counter, and now he and eat even more of that junky food. That's what they're promoting.
Yeah, let's dive into a couple of these. How about asthma? That's something, why would asthma be connected to heartburn and IBS? Right.
That's a great idea because that could be certainly new information.
Oh, why? In fact, I on digestivehealthinstitute.org, I wrote a blog article on asthma. People with asthma should read it because I firmly believe there's a dietary approach to asthma instead of all those other drugs. Asthma is interesting. If you look at kids with asthma, 80% of kids with asthma suffer with chronic acid reflux. Why is that? Right? It's fascinating. But, you know, the drug companies were quick to jump on that. They said, oh, okay, asthma is connected to acid reflux, so all we have to do is treat these kids that have asthma with Nexium. And they did a big study, 1,000 kids, multi-center study all over the U.S. They gave all these kids Nexium. And the results were no improvement at all. And so, and this paper, they published this result, and there were, oh, I think, over 100 authors on this paper. And their conclusion was, and I believe it was a faulty conclusion, they said since Nexium did not help with asthma, that acid reflux does not cause asthma. But they made a mistake there, I firmly believe. And that's because all they did was take the acid component away by neutralizing the stomach acid or blocking the production of stomach acid with Nexium. The reflux aid, all right, because there's a connection. Acid reflux, we know through like laryngopharyngeal reflux, reflux can go not just to the lower esophagus and give you heartburn, but it can go all the way up into your mouth and cause problems with tooth enamel, into your inner ears and your sinuses, and it also can be aspirated into your lungs. And back before I realized this connection with diet, I actually suffered from that one night myself. I breathed in this, you know, acidic refluxate, and I thought I was dying. But it's not the acid, so it must be something else. You know, there's a lot of things, other things in refluxate, digestive enzymes like pepsin and other enzymes, bile, which can be very, you know, caustic, even bacteria from the small intestine, especially according to my theory, with bacteria overgrowing, causing the reflux. And so something else in refluxate, in my view, is responsible for exacerbating asthma. You know, there's an interesting couple of studies that they ignored in forming their conclusions. Did you know that if you treat people, instead of using drugs, you give them a fundoplication operation, right? And for your listeners, that's an operation where they actually surgically take the lower part of the upper stomach, the fundus part of the stomach, and they wrap it around the esophagus, tightening it, and then they put some sutures in. And so the lower esophageal sphincter is tighter, and so it makes reflux much less, it makes you much less able to reflux. And those people have dramatically improved asthma symptoms and can lessen or go off the medications. So it is the reflux, I'm absolutely sure, but it's not the acid component, and that's why the Nexium didn't work. However, the fast-track diet, by limiting lactose, fructose, resistant starch, fiber, and sugar alcohols, it's just like a weight loss plan that works on points. You know, you control the points. You don't have to give up any foods, but you control the points. And so it's designed to control the actual reflux. And that's why one of the books I will be writing is asthma. There'll be a fast track digestion book on asthma. So,
and you have love recipes in all of your books to make it really very easy. This isn't a diet where you're going to be starving.
No. In fact, the people that, you know, that want even easier, we actually came up with a fast-track diet mobile app for both Android and iTunes, which has lists these FP values. We haven't really talked about that, but these are like a Weight Watcher scale for over 800 foods. And so that's very easy for people to use. Some people don't want to read so much about the theory, they want to jump right into it. But yeah, that's where we're going. You want to talk about the cystic fibrosis for a minute? You have a moment for that?
Well, that's of course a really important discussion, although it's not as widespread as something like heartburn. But yes, we certainly can talk about it.
No, it isn't, but it's still, you know, for kids that have it, it's really terrible. But, you know, we can talk about it on another show, but it's just, it's, when you're looking at these conditions through a different lens, it's amazing what you can find because you're looking at it completely differently from how mainstream medicine is viewing the same condition. Same with autoimmune conditions. They now know that there's this almost every autoimmune disease involves a leaky gut. And
yes, and you know what? I still to this day get from physicians, quote unquote, "I do not believe in leaky gut," as if it is some kind of religion.
Yeah, I just don't understand it. They should read Fasano's papers, the Italian researcher that's made all of the connections between leaky gut and proteins as well as gluten and other inflammatory exacerbators of leaky gut. I mean, it's fairly well studied at this point. It's intestinal permeability. If you search the research...
Well, there you go. Wait, you just said a magic word. What I do, that's what I was going to bring up. If we're speaking to a professional audience, I have found it's really best to not use the word leaky gut and discuss intestinal permeability. Because if you use intestinal permeability on PubMed, that's where you get into the mainstream journals.
Yeah, I agree. But
it's the same thing.
It's only a matter of time. It's a huge thing right now, and they'll just have to get with the program.
Yes and no. I think where the pressure comes in is from people like our listeners, and many of our listeners are, in fact, healthcare providers, but also healthcare consumers. Because I always teach anyone I work with that as a healthcare consumer, whether you're also a provider or not, you are the employer.
Mm-hmm.
The person you're going to see is your employee, because you're the one ultimately paying the bills, even though it feels like you're not if you have health insurance.
Right. But by voters, we should do the same thing.
Insisting, bring in the studies, a book like your book, where you have a massive array of...
A lot of readers that take our books to their gastroenterologist, and we now have some GI docs recommending our approach. So, you know, it's a process. It doesn't happen overnight.
But if they show that to them, and a doctor should say, you know, even if they can say it is true, and I don't mind if they say that, gee, you know what, I am not familiar with this, but if you want to try it, I will stand by you and do all the evaluations, make sure you're okay, take blood work, and whatever you need to follow you, I will work with you like that, and yeah, you want to do this? Fine. But if they tell you, oh, that doesn't work, I don't believe in leaky gut, you know, I really feel it's time to fire that healthcare provider and work with somebody who actually is reasonably interested in the science.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And that's why when I write these books, that's why there's over 100 journal references in there. People don't need to read it. They want to take my word for it. But I also put the references right where I'm making the point. So they can go and look up that reference, say, what he's saying right or not? They can go look at the science. And so that's, in a way, I write that part for the doctors. You know, the same way my brother's a builder and a carpenter, and whenever, we used to do some work together, whenever a board wasn't completely straight, I'd say, you know, that doesn't matter. Let's just move on. He said, other carpenters would notice.
Funny, because I had a friend who was a carpenter in Bisbee, Arizona many years ago, and the name of his company was Close Enough Construction. And I thought that was really, really funny and actually close to what goes on in a lot of those things. But yet you're saying, you know, there's a level of excellence that people can adhere to.
Right.
We're going to take one more break right now, and that's going to be to have station identifications, and so other people can actually listen to some of the great shows that are here on Progressive Radio Network. And remember, Dr. Norm, I will send you a link as well, because this show will be archived. So if you listeners want your friends to check out what we're talking about today on digestive health and the fast track diet, they can always come to the website at Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, and click on the link. It will go right to DigestiveHealthInstitute.org and Dr. Norm's other information. So we will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And Robillard, PhD, author of Fast Track Digestion, IBS, Fast Track Digestion Heartburn, and more Fast Track books on the way, as well as a wonderful app. Now, you talked about GERD and IBS a little bit. Let's go more into SIBO, because we need to say, what is SIBO stand for? And I think that's the reason why they're moving so much to antibiotics as a therapeutic for these issues.
Right. And in fact, when I came up with my theory of acid reflux in 2004, I honestly didn't even know what SIBO was. I came up with this theory based on my understanding of intestinal bacteria. But after that, I began to realize that was this term SIBO for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And there's another companion term called dysbiosis, which is more of a general imbalance in gut microbes, but that could extend to the large intestine as well. But SIBO, it's an overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine, and it's typically defined as greater than 10,000 bacterial cells per milliliter in the small intestine. However, that's really not a very good definition, though, because in the early part of the small intestine, where our own critical digestion takes place, where we have these villi and microvilli structures with these delicate digestive enzymes on the tips of the microvilli that help us complete the breakdown of carbohydrates, we want almost no bacteria there because it can really disrupt and damage these microvilli and enzymes. So, but regardless, when you have this overgrowth, all these bacteria up in your small intestine, there's a number of symptoms. And they include, you know, a lot of the things we talked about, but, you know, abdominal pain, cramps, diarrhea, constipation, gas, bloating, talked about reflux, but even flatulence and nausea, dehydration and fatigue. And then if it continues on unabated or untreated, you can have more severe symptoms that include things like weight loss. And we work with a lot of these people that have, you know, quite serious repercussions from SIBO. In kids, you can get failure to thrive where they don't grow normally. Steatorrhea, where the body has a failure to digest fats properly. And even anemia, right? You're not absorbing certain vitamins like B12. Well, bleeding, bruising, night blindness, even bone pain and fractures, because also you're not absorbing calcium and magnesium as well. And we talked about leaky gut and immune reactions. So there's a lot of symptoms, but then, as we mentioned, there's a growing, you know, body of scientific research linking SIBO to all of these other conditions. And I mentioned a handful of them, but there's actually over 30 or 40 of these.
Yeah, and so many people suffer with a wide range of those symptoms.
Yeah, they do. It's very common, over 100 million people. But, you know, in our program, when we work with people that have SIBO, first of all, we oftentimes confirm it with a hydrogen breath test. They drink a lactulose solution. They do this through their doctor, or you can also get the test tubes mailed to your home, do it at home. You take drink a lactulose solution. The sugar is not digested or absorbed. So if there's bacteria in your small intestine, they will ferment the sugar and produce gases like hydrogen and methane. And humans don't produce those gases, only bacteria. So they're absorbed in your bloodstream, and when you exhale, they're in your breath. And so what you do is you drink the lactulose, you take a zero time point breath sample by just with a straw blowing in a tube, and then every 15 minutes after you drink the lactulose, you blow in a new tube, and then you cap those and send them all to the lab, and they basically plot how much hydrogen and or methane you're producing over time. And from that, they can see where the bacteria is in your small intestine and how much it is. And so that's a really good test. But when we work with people with SIBO, I talked about the underlying cause, right? The book and the app and our practice is all based on essentially a three-pillar strategy, the diet, and we talked about limiting those types of carbs, pro-digestion behaviors. But the third piece is, and the pro-digestion behaviors is really a fascinating
Wait,
piece.
I don't want you to pass over that too quickly. What
back,
are pro-digestion behaviors?
We'll get back to that one. But then the third piece, this gets to what we're talking about, is potential underlying causes that could exacerbate or be responsible for the SIBO. And those include things like slowed motility, right? You've heard about the migrating motor complex. Food needs to move through your digestive tract at a reasonable pace. Too much? diarrhea, too slow, constipation, and so forth. So motility, low stomach acid. Some people have prolonged H. pylori infections, which can lead to atrophic gastritis, and a deficiency in your stomach acid. Immune deficiencies caused by either drugs or certain viruses. Antibiotic usage. All right, they're treating SIBO with antibiotics, but antibiotics can actually cause SIBO in the first place. Gastrointestinal infection.
Well, it certainly often does. You know, that's one of the reasons resistant strains develop.
Yep. Food or water poisoning, so a gastroenteritis infection. Intestinal surgery or any kind of scarring. There was a paper out last year on ileocecal valve problems, so the break between the large intestine and the small, so bacteria gets back into the small intestine more easily. But the key, in my mind, is carbohydrate malabsorption. You know, though each of these different things I listed can increase your chances of having SIBO, the driving force is these poorly absorbed carbohydrates because, as I mentioned, gut bacteria consume mostly carbs for energy. And so the best way to control SIBO, you need to look at these other problems and address them wherever you can. Another one I didn't have on the list is particular enzyme deficiencies, amylase, lactase. So for those, you can treat those with supplements. But you really need to cut back on these five types of carbs. And we're not eliminating them, but we're just limiting them like a Weight Watchers program. And the worst hard-to-digest carbs is lactose, fructose, resistant starch, fiber, and sugar alcohols. And that's what people need to remember. Not eliminate them, but control, because we just eat too many of them as part of our Western diet with all the snack foods and everything.
Well, I think sugar alcohols can be totally eliminated very easily. You just read your labels and don't use packaged products. I mean, they don't really come up in a natural food as much.
Well, you can. Now, some foods do have some naturally occurring sugar alcohols, and the FODMAP approach, you know, talks about that a little bit. But if they're added to foods, you're right. By law, it needs to be on the label, so you can look at that. And I agree with you on sugar alcohols with one exception, and it's called erythritol. It's a natural sugar alcohol made by a fungi, and it's a sugar substitute, and it is not absorbed very well, and it's not processed by a body or gut microbes. So it's a very safe, natural sugar alternative. But the other sugar alcohols, they will. They'll lead to diarrhea and bloating, and you really should just eliminate or avoid those.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of erythritol either. And there are some reports, although definitely less, of similar gastrointestinal negative effects, but certainly to a lesser degree than some of the others. But why do we need it at all? I mean, why not just stick to natural foods?
Well, that's true. But if you have a sweet tooth like me and you eat sugar, that's the worst thing for you. Not only, you know, for your metabolic health, but also for your digestive health. Because
that's
sucrose,
true.
Table sugar is half fructose. So, and it gives it a lower glycemic index, which results in a higher FP points. That's what we count in our diet. And so you can use dextrose. Dextrose is just pure powdered glucose. It's not as sweet as sucrose, but it's easy to digest and absorb. And it won't
well, let's talk about your app, because we're getting actually really close to the end of the show, and it's been very fascinating. Thank you for being our guest. We've been talking to Dr. Norman Robillard, R-O-B-I-L-L-A-R-D, and you certainly may want to go to the website at digestivehealthinstitute.org, and that will be listed with a click-through right on the archive of this show. But just tell us what that app is about, because I don't even know what apps are, but I'm sure many of our listeners do.
Yeah. Well, you know, it basically gives you the, instead of reading the book, you get it right on your phone, so you can be in the grocery store, has voice recognition, and you can say asparagus. And it'll come up on your screen, and it will tell you how many points it has, and you could figure out what serving size would be reasonable for you to consume. And so the app has these FP values, and maybe on another show we can talk about this calculation that I developed, which makes the diet quantitative and more like a Weight Watchers plan. But it's for digestive health. So these FP values are really critical, and it has these values for over 800 different foods. And you can also put your own custom recipes and foods into the app and make meal plans as well. And then there's a tracker that tracks your meals and your daily FP points. And so you can look at it for a week or a month view, and you can see how high your points are going and how high your symptoms are going, because you can enter all of your symptoms on a scale of 1 to 10 for each one as well, into the app. And so you can see, and most people that are submitting these to me now in our program, you can really see these FP points for these hard-to-digest carbs. As they go up, the symptoms go up. It's really an amazing little device. But
so that's a wonderful tool for
popular.
People
we
to
worked
take.
For 2 years on it, but released it about 4 months ago, 5 months ago.
Excellent. So it's new, and people can go right to digestivehealthinstitute.org to find out more. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And I'd like to thank you, listeners, for joining us once again. And as always, we'd love to invite you to comment directly to us. Go to naturalnurse.com, click on Contact Us to send an email, or Facebook The Natural Nurse, where you can like us and find out about many of our events and also look at the calendar. So once again, thank you so much for joining us for another edition right here on Progressive Radio Network for The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Until next time, we'd love to wish that you